Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Classics World Chat Show. Today you join us in rather illustrious surroundings, the Great British Car Journey here in Matlock Bath. Hundreds of fantastic, primarily British made products of cars from all sorts of brands, many of which are no longer with us. Quite poignant that. So chaps, what we're going to talk about today is the marks that we've lost, because in the world of classics there are a lot of brands that we talk about and names that we've lost to history for various reasons, politics and mergers and whatever, and which ones we would bring back, because a lot of people say, oh, if they still existed today they'd be popular and they'd be successful, but which ones do we actually think would have legs? Now Paul, obviously you're not the most regular on this show of the channel as it were, what would you bring back? If you could bring any legacy car brand back that we've lost?
Tour all of that, isn't there? There are so many of them, but I mean, we had a chat earlier on and I was saying, what about Saab? You know, that had a unique place in the market and now it's gone. Volvo and Saab, they were sort of level pegging as a sort of almost premium. Volvo's still with us really, but Saab, yeah, gone.
Why do you think they aren't with us anymore? There's all sorts of reasons we lost Saab, really.
Well, yeah, it can be controversial, can't it? General Motors copied it up, didn't they? That's the accepted answer, isn't it?
But it's interesting, isn't it? If you chart the fate of Saab versus Volvo throughout the 90s, when Volvo just seemed to could do no wrong, the touring car era, the 850s and all that kind of stuff. And their product line just got better and better, whereas for some reason, Saab seemed to get worse. There was a dilution of the brand, sort of the Cavalier-based 900 and things like that.
Well, you said that it lost the kind of Saab core value.
Well, it does, yeah. We had a 9.3, actually. I just happened to feel the back of the column stalks for some reason, and it was like one of those really cheap children's beach spades that you got in the 70s. You know, they hadn't even finished the back of the moulding properly. And, you know, someone commented, yeah, look, it's lasted 100,000 miles, but it just felt horrible, and when you worked it, it clanked, and I just thought, well, there you go. You know, people who were buying Saabs because it was a sort of almost a BMW, almost, you know.
Quality product.
They didn't want it to feel like that, and so they drifted off. They may as well have bought a Vauxhall instead, and that was the problem. It was a Vauxhall underneath, and they just put a little bit of quirkiness here and there. It wasn't enough.
It was tokenist, wasn't it?
Yeah, it didn't help.
And it didn't sort of have those sort of Saab core values, because ultimately, like, it's one thing to last, but it doesn't feel like a premium product, which it should still be, given how much they cost as well. They were BMW money.
Yeah, they had the turbocharged thing was their USP at one point, but of course the rest of the world caught up. And interestingly, Saab could have been so very different, because when Jaguar were trying to resist being taken over by Ford, Sir John Egan's memoir points this out. They had a team in Sweden ready to do the deal with Saab if they couldn't do the deal with Jaguar. So, you know, if things had gone differently, Saab might have been ended up part of Ford.
Back with Ford, oh wow.
Look how well Ford did with Jaguar. Controversial comment, I know, but I think they did do well with Jaguar.
Yeah,
I'm going to stand by that forever, and I think history's going to prove me right very soon. But anyway, yeah, we could have seen some really neat Saabs, and it would have been Jaguar that would have disappeared.
All new platforms. You know,
yeah. It's almost a tension, isn't it, with a company like Saab, which is a bit left field and does slightly quirky things, that if it then tries to chase sort of volume sale, it then loses some of its identity in the process.
Who else do we know who does that?
Exactly. And arguably under GM, that's exactly the mistake they made. They tried to chase volume and then they become more mainstream, and it dilutes the sort of idiosyncrasies that make Saab a Saab. And we see that sometimes with Citroën.
Yeah.
When Citroën sort of tries to go mainstream and chase the sales, it loses that sort of quirkiness that we like Citroëns for.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're right. There are bits of those latter subs where the quirkiness kind of shines through. I mean, there's a video coming on the 9.3X all-wheel drive, which is such a weird and wild car, and arguably it came too late. But the trouble is, there were things like, by the end, they were weird, but not necessarily in a good way. Mr. Whedon, what would you bring back from the dead?
Well, I have to say, we're doing this podcast in a particularly good environment of the Great British Car Journey.
Many British brands.
There are lots and lots of British brands celebrated here, and I love the juxtapositioning of traditional British brands like Rolls-Royce and Bentley and Aston Martin, and we're right next to some production Toyotas, which are built just 15 miles up the road from where we're sitting here today. So British manufacturing is still actually alive and well. We're making things like Nissans and Toyotas, but not the sort of traditional British brands. So, but there is one British brand that I would dearly like to bring back from the dead, and that is Triumph. I've always liked the model lineups. There's so many models in its particularly sort of post-war history I really like. And they're not all the same either. Like, you know, I've always liked a Herald, and the Vitesse.
GT6 and the Spitfire and all
that
lot. Yeah,
and I love the TR range. I think there's a sweet spot around TR5, TR6. Also, the Stag gets a lot of beating for overheating problems and all that kind of stuff. But the Stag is great. It's just proper sort of bruising sort of V8 powered cabriolet, call it what you will, and I love that model. And then you've got the cheeky little Spitfire and the GT6. There's such a lovely broad range. And it's a shame. I mean, I think the TR7 could have been an amazing car had it not been brought out in the middle of a fuel crisis and concerns about North America banning convertibles and general British Leyland production quality malaise, because that TR7 was quite visionary. And while it was quite a break from the TR6, I think it was still a great car. Well, imagine that car now, slightly evolved for, you know, crash protection and a slightly sort of more modernised dashboard. And I think it would stand its own now. Yeah. You know, I think it's that good. Then there were the rumours when BMW bought Rover, they technically owned the Triumph.
They sort of still do.
I believe they still do. And there was talk about maybe bringing back the Triumph name, maybe a rebadged BMW Z3 or something like that. And that makes you sort of hanker after the idea of a British sports car. And if one of the sort of German or Japanese car makers did try and ape Triumph, I think they could do a really good job with it, actually. You know, you sort of think about a BMW Z4 potentially sort of rebadged and re-engineered to be a bit more Britishy.
A bit more sort of leather and wood and all that. Because you think what they did with the Honda Rovers, you know, they took Honda Ballard, added the British touches, and made it a more rovery appropriate. You could do that with a Triumph, with a BMW. It wouldn't be the hardest thing in the world to do.
Well, of course, they did the Mini.
They did
pretty well with that. So
yeah, they sold a couple of those.
Yes, mostly to estate agents. But yeah, no, it was good. But I think Triumph just has enough quality and
prestige almost.
Yeah, I love the fact that they sort of seem to run quite a nice middle ground between maybe overtly sporting like a Jaguar or luxury like Rover. They kind of did fit quite nicely in the middle ground there.
They sort of are a British BMW in a lot of ways when you look
exactly
at the
as
sort
opposed
of
to a Japanese Mercedes.
A Lexus, but yeah. The brand identity as they would say in marketing these days, like you say, is very much the British BMW.
And of course you all know this, Triumph motorcycles have been back now for 30 years.
Yes, I mean the thing is the car division and the motorcycle division were split a long time ago. I mean, decades and decades ago, but the Triumph motorcycle division is immensely successful. You know, they win racing championships, and that you look, every motorcycle you count the next 10 motorcycles you see when you're out and about, at least one of them will be a Triumph. They're incredibly successful.
It shows there was equity in the brand to bring the bike bit back.
Definitely.
How wonderful would it be to bring the car bit back?
You they know. Even bring the heritage name. You can buy a Triumph Bonneville today, which is a name from the 50s. You know, it's a heritage name. So that heritage with the name, it still exists. There's still nostalgia for it. Yeah. It's just working out where it would sit in the market.
So yeah, so Triumph for me all day long. What about you, sir?
That's a triumphant choice, sir. Well, mine is a British brand that it's still fairly fresh in the mind because we didn't lose it that long ago, relatively speaking. But I would like to bring Rover back.
Hear, hear.
And I think the way you bring Rover back, and you and I have talked about this, is it's almost got to be that kind of, maybe even the pre-BL era of Rover. You know, when they made cars like the P4 and the P5, and they were kind of engineering enterprise, and they were built like tanks, and they were just deliberately left of field and being their own thing. You know, a Rover P4 is nothing like anything else, and a P6 is like a spaceship compared to what Ford were making at the time. And I appreciate, obviously, it got diluted under BL. A lot of people don't even consider the 800 a proper Rover, let alone the R8. There is still a bit of that clinging on, because like we've touched on before, the R8 isn't a real Rover, if you're a purist, but it's still a really good car, and it's different enough to the Honda on which it's based. Even something like the SD1, you know, it's got that rakish sort of modern styling. There was enough sort of pioneering spirit in Rover that did live on through the decades, even under BL ownership and being downtrodden in terms of finances, and the spirit of the brand that made cars like the P4, the P6 lived on, and I think it deserves to be back, really.
It's testimony, really, I guess, to Rover's reputation and engineering integrity of old is why it did live on through the 80s, arguably surpassing Austin, because obviously Austin Rover throughout the 80s, but Rover lived on. And you know, I can't remember the numbers, but didn't the Rover SD3 pretty much match sales for the Montego at one point? Yeah. Like Montego sales and SD3 sales were quite aligned, and that shouldn't have been the case with the Rover. Should have been the niche prestige product, the Montego should have been the volume seller.
Whether that says more about the Montego, I don't know.
Well, it may well do, but essentially what you've got is a brand that clearly did enough stuff well in the past to see it through those slightly difficult days of the 80s when it was trying to establish itself with that Honda title.
The beginning of the end for Rover, think cars like the 25 and the 45 and so on. There's not a lot of pure, like a Rover purist who likes a P6 or a P4 wouldn't even give those the time of day. But actually in their right, they're still good cars. Mm-hmm. There's enough left field spirit that I think that brand would have a place if it were to come back.
Well, it's not the engineering though, is it? It's not only the engineering, it's the need to chase volume and the break-even point. And you know, yeah, there was no place in the car industry for a mass market player that couldn't play hard enough in volume.
Well, that's what you even see Mercedes-Benz. You know, back in the 80s, no one built cars as well as Mercedes, and by the 90s, they're rusting when they're barely out of warranty. You know, so it's like you say, it's one thing to build a high quality product, but you reach an era where a high quality product doesn't necessarily sell in volume, and that's ultimately how you keep the lights on. I don't know where Rover could sit in the market. It'd almost have to sit where Triumph could hypothetically sit, and then you end up with the debate of which one would you bring back. Not above or below a BMW, they almost have to sit off to one side as that kind of more British take on it. But then the trouble you'd have these days is it would almost be like a pastiche. If you went too kind of walnut and cream leather and button back seats, would it feel a bit too
British infinity?
Yeah, exactly.
Was that where BMW ultimately went wrong? Because I mean, in theory, BMW being the sporty version and Rover being the sort of more luxury version should have been ideal. So 3 Series and 75 and so on should have worked really well. But maybe by then it was too late.
I think it could have worked if, as with so many other companies, if the stuff behind the scenes had been good, that's fine. But that famous line where BMW referred to Rover as their sick English patient, you know, and things like that, their heart was never really in it, I think was the problem. And that's the thing. Had everything been rosy behind the scenes, the core product would have reflected that. And the 75 is still a damn good car.
I heard maybe apocryphal, but it was on another podcast. They were talking about when BMW first took over Rover, they took the all of the current range, which at that time included the Rover 800, back to Munich to sort of effectively take them apart and reevaluate them. And they took the Rover 800 out on a piece of Autobahn, and above 100 miles an hour, the wipers lifted off the windscreen, so they wouldn't have worked.
You don't get that in a 3 Series, do you?
And the seals around the sunroofs were so bad, it was causing a downdraft from the sunroof, like into the cabin, to the point where BMW engineers were almost incredulous that this thing got passed, because it wouldn't have passed BMW's own development processes,
let alone made it to production.
So
that's my thing with Rover, is I think, but whenever we cover them in videos, we always kind of have that gently apologetic nature, because even though there were a lot of flaws with the brand, particularly towards the end, a bit of you still wants it to survive. Would they sell in big volume to challenge Ford and what have you now if they came out? Probably not. But
I'll tell you the other interesting thing about the three brands that we've chosen is that the way they sort of slightly peter out with an unfortunate sort of finale car. And I'm sort of thinking, you know, the last Saab 9.3, I think.
Or 9.5,
And the 9.5 could have been okay. That was the Insignia-based one.
Sort of half-assed electric
thing
that dribbled out at the end.
The City Rover, the IndyCar thing from Tata.
And then Triumph, the last car they really made was the Acclaim, which was a Honda.
Yeah.
Now, a very, very pivotal car, a very important car, but not exactly in the lineage of the TR6.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And it's unfortunate that was kind of deemed suitable for Triumph, and we shouldn't be surprised that it did ultimately... It did ultimately peter out, but I don't know.
Like you say, none of them went out with a bang. It was all more of a stuttered whimper. It was a bit of a shame.
Which is a shame. But maybe by then there was an air of inevitability about it anyway.
So. Yeah, that's probably fair. You read magazine reports on some of those last Saabs, and you kind of, the underlying tone is, how much longer are they going to be selling these? You know, and it's...
Wacky Subaru crossovers as well.
The 92X, yes.
That's right.
Yeah, Subaru.
Because it is exactly, again, that's not a purebred Saab.
Yeah, I've seen a few in Canada. They don't look very happy.
I've got other brands. Obviously, I couldn't come to the chat show with just one answer.
There's a TVR down there and a Reliant.
I didn't even write TVR.
TVR? They're not coming back, are they?
That's a great one. What about things like Talbot? We've just driven
Chrysler Avenger. We've covered Talbots this year. We need to see a modern Matra Rancho, because you think the trend these days for cars that look 4x4e but can't actually go off-road.
That was it.
A Matra Rancho would fit right
so
in.
So you can blame that car for your hatred of SUVs.
Polo June, yes. I've got the City, the Streetwise, the Rover Streetwise.
Ahead of its time, that.
What brands do we think are maybe not long for this world? If we look at 10 or 15 years' time, might not be here, or might be owned by someone else, or might not have the strength.
Of legacy car makers in Western Europe, I would say all of them. All of them are at risk. Every single one of them.
Not BMW
or Mercedes. Probably those two would survive. But I think Volkswagen really struggled, didn't they?
Volkswagen are in trouble. And Ford. Yeah, there's an argument.
Stellantis are already hedging their bets by bringing in the electric Chinese stuff. So, you know.
There's an element that, you know, that's quite harrowing, isn't it? When you hear that, you're suddenly
It does feel like a changing of the guard. It has to be said that the move to electrification, rightly or wrongly, is meaning that Chinese manufacturers are going to come in with cheaper cars that are not, you know, I don't think inferior necessarily. So
yeah, well, that's the thing. You mentioned Lada a bit ago. In the days when you could buy a Lada and an old style Skoda and whatnot, they were pretty awful, really, in comparison to a used Western car. But these Chinese cars, I've driven a few of them. I got friends that work in the industry, and
they're
all right. Yeah. I drove one recently, and I thought, this is really nice. Like, it wasn't just all right; it was excellent.
It was good.
You know, so controversially, I think of the big scalps, I think Ford of Europe. So Ford, I think, in the US,
they'll survive.
I think
it's
big enough, and F-150s, and they've got some great stuff.
I think I'm going to say the one we're all thinking, the legacy brand that will not be with us in 10 years' time, or is it very unlikely? You can make a fairly safe bet. Jaguar.
Yeah, well, it's gone already, hasn't it? Mm. This cyber attack won't have helped.
No, that's very true.
Yeah, we're recording this just at the sort of end of September, and they're still blighted by this cyber attack which hit them at the beginning of the month. So here we are, 3 or 4 weeks in, and they're not building any cars.
And is there much of a market for this super luxury executive car?
They've been floundering for years. Coming back to your theory of that, you know, the image associated with the brand goes down and down and down, and then the final car is sort of a whimper that no one really remembers. Well, the last new car that Jaguar made was the E-Pace, wasn't it? As flounders for a brand that was once great go, sadly.
You drive a nice late model XF or something. It's really, you know, XF RS or something. It's really nice.
F-type.
I mean, it stands comparison with the BMW and the F-Type and everything. But, you know, they threw that away.
Well, that's a bit doom and gloom, isn't it? Every brand is doomed and we're going to be all buying Chinese EVs.
But what that means we will have to gravitate more to classics.
Is that why you've bought a Rover?
Yes.
There you go. Why don't you let us know, which brand would you bring back from the dead? Historic brands, ones that have gone or ones that are just about to go,
Jaguar.
Which brands would you bring back from the dead and what place do you think they would have in today's market? But in the meantime, we have done videos on all the brands we've talked about. There's a video coming on the history of Saab. There's all sorts of stuff coming.
We done any videos on Panther?
He keeps on about Panther. We're going to have to. If someone's got a Panther Callista, can we do a video on one, please? Because he is obsessed with Panther Callistas. But in the meantime, subscribe to Classics World for all our future content. Do go and check out the other episodes of the chat show. We've had all sorts of guests on. Last month was Matt from Furious Driving. We talked about 90s cars. It was excellent. But in the meantime, thanks very much for watching. We'll see you again soon. Ta-ra.
See you.